Hi, you're with Truth News Radio Australia, broadcasting to you on the 5th of July 2014. My name's Hereward Fenton, very pleased to be with you today. Well, in today's two-hour show, we'll be covering a range of topics from Australia and overseas. And in the second hour of today's show, I'm bringing you an exclusive interview with Paul Gunter, who is director of the Reactor Oversight Project at beyondnuclear.org, a nuclear power watchdog group that is bringing information to the general public about many of the problems in nuclear energy around the world. And one of the main foci of their work at the moment is alerting people to what is going on at Fukushima Daiichi nuclear reactor, 3 years after the catastrophic failure of that reactor after the earthquake and tsunami. Things are still not looking good. In fact, they're getting worse. And of course, this has not been explained by the news organizations around the world, by any of the mainstream media. The real situation at Fukushima is being continually covered up. There is a huge operation ongoing to try and contain and deal with the problems there, but part of the massaging of public opinion has always been to just suppress information. We just don't know. We don't hear about what's going on. So a big focus of my interview today with Paul Gunter will be Fukushima, but we'll also be talking about nuclear power across the board, around the world, and we'll be talking about what Paul sees as being the main threats from nuclear energy. And there's quite a range of them, and it's a complex topic. And the problems with this technology cut across many different types of problem. By saying that, what I mean is it's not just the problem of the toxicity or the potential for leaks or the levels of risk that you have to deal with. There's also very sensitive geopolitical questions because of the close alignment of nuclear power technology with nuclear weapons technology, because the two technologies have always gone hand in hand. And this creates a big problem for world peace when any country decides to develop even purely peaceful nuclear technology. It always comes under suspicion that they are probably developing nuclear weapons, because it's always possible to do that as a byproduct of developing peaceful nuclear power. So this is a very interesting question too. So we will be discussing all of that in hour two of the show, so do stay with us. Now, in hour one of the show, I've got a few interesting little nuggets to bring to you today, and I'm going to start with a piece here that was put up on Expendable.tv. That's the group that is working to expose the false conviction of Chappelle Corby and the amazing amount of work that they've done on their website that you can see at Expendable.tv. One of the things that the Expendable group has highlighted, and I think it's very important, very worthwhile, is the language of manipulation which is used by the media. And this extends to many other subjects beyond the case of Chappelle. The media these days is coordinated, and that they use specific language to smear people or movements that they don't like, that they want you to have a negative impression on, and they appear to do it in a very, very consistent, very deliberate, orchestrated way. And there's a piece that was put up on here about Edward Snowden and Chappelle Corby, the language of manipulation. And we saw with Edward Snowden that the phrase fame-seeking narcissist was continually used again and again. As we saw with Chappelle Corby, the phrase convicted drug smuggler. Now, the technique used by these news organizations is to, whenever they introduce this person, they always have the little tag phrase. And so it is just a form of brainwashing, actually. It's just, it goes into your brain, you process it as Edward Snowden, the fame-seeking narcissist, Chappelle Corby, the convicted drug smuggler. And so it's impossible for you to have an objective view of that person. I mean, it's ridiculous, isn't it? It's stupid. But it probably does work. You know, people are susceptible to this kind of brainwashing, especially when it's done over and over again on all the news channels. You know, you just change from channel to channel and they're saying the same thing over and over again. And of course, we as human beings are are a tribal species, and we get our keys, our cues for what to think from what other people are saying. And when we live in a fairly atomized society where we don't really have a big community around us, but we always have the TV is our community. You see, we don't really talk to each other much. We have small groups of friends. We get up, we go to work, we come home. Our lives are fairly restricted in terms of how we communicate with others. And of course, people at work never talk about questions of politics or sensitive topics. I know that. People are afraid to. They won't talk about it. And they won't generally talk about it with their friends either because it's tacky and you don't want to get into arguments. So the only time people ever actually absorb information about sensitive, important political questions is when they turn on the TV. And of course, when they turn on the TV, they get an orchestrated delivery of the same talking points over and over again, no matter which channel they go to. And of course, we are naturally susceptible then to believing that that is the reality. But of course, we've always known that, and I know this is just going over very old ground, but the point here is that the journalists and the news organizations are going to extraordinary lengths to brainwash people. They are deliberately creating these memes, these little tag phrases to literally brainwash you. And it's really something, folks. And I've got a piece here, Glenn Greenwald, talking about the Edward Snowden issue. And, you know, Glenn Greenwald is certainly not a conspiracy theorist type guy. He's a very mainstream journalist, but he has cut into, he has delved into the type of work that is deeply challenging to the status quo. So there has been enormous effort to marginalize him. So I'm just going to play to you a clip now from a speech that Glenn Greenwald gave recently. Here we go.
Did go back in the course of writing this book to look at what the discourse was in the immediate aftermath of Snowden's unveiling. And I was really amazed because I've been pretty scornful of the notion that there's this active plotting among journalists and media outlets to coordinate their storyline. I generally think that they don't need to plot. They're just sort of appendages of a certain culture, and it just kind of comes naturally the way they all embrace each other's conventional wisdom. But within 24 to 48 hours, literally after we first introduced Edward Snowden to the world, there was this immediate consensus among all of these media elites that they were completely capable of taking this person that they had never heard of before and didn't know the first thing about and like diagnosing him, like clinically diagnosing him, like psychologically assessing his pathologies. And they all somehow settled on this incredibly coordinated script that he was a fame-seeking narcissist. This is, I mean, if you Google it, you'll find this phrase over and over and over again, that this was the mental imbalance that led him to do what he did. It was obviously not any genuine dissatisfaction with the U.S. government or what it was doing, because how could any sane person possibly be dissatisfied with the U.S. government? There must be a mental condition that led him to do what he did. And that was the one they settled on. And it didn't just amaze me how coordinated it was. Like, where did they all get that? Where did that come from, that fame-seeking narcissist theme? I really want to know.
So that's Edward Snowden. Now, this phrase, fame-seeking narcissist, indeed, it was used over and over again. And that, no doubt, had some impact in terms of smearing Edward Snowden with a no basis whatsoever. Well, let's now turn to Chappelle Corby, where the phrase convicted drug smuggler has been used for a similar purpose. Now, of course, you might argue that in the case of Chappelle Corby, she was a convicted drug smuggler, therefore it's not really manipulation. Yes, you could argue that, but what is incredible in this case is the number of times this phrase was used and the consistency with which it was used. I'm going to play to you some clips here now. And you'll see over and over again that this phrase is repeated. I mean, it's just, and in Google, there's hundreds of instances of that specific phrase, thousands of instances of those words being used together in articles, in news articles that you can find in Google.
Convicted drug smuggler Chappelle Corby.
Convicted
Bali drug smuggler Chappelle Corby.
Convicted drug smuggler Chappelle Corby.
And the video here I'm watching is illustrating a test that you can run. You can put human rights abuse victim Chappelle Corby, imprisoned Australian Chappelle Corby, wrongly convicted Chappelle Corby, 27-year-old Chappelle Corby, and you get zero results for any of those. Zero results. If you put convicted drug smuggler Chappelle Corby in, you get 370 results, and you get over 1,600 without the quotes around that phrase.
The convicted drug smuggler Chappelle Corby.
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 Now, those last cases there that were quoted were from the ABC, and it says here in the video that there are 3,400 such quotes from the ABC. I'm not sure about that, but that's what it says here in the video. I wouldn't be surprised. The ABC has been incredibly complicit in this smear campaign against Chappelle Corby. Now, of course, the use of these tag phrases extends in all directions. I mean, it's used so widely now. One must wonder what's going on. I mean, it really does make you conspiratorial, even thinking about this, even trying to grasp what's going on. It appears very conspiratorial. Of course, we've seen the use of terms like denier that are used again and again in relation to those who disagree with climate change or vaccines. And of course, denier is directly associated with the term Holocaust denier, which again is an elaborate meme about people who have questions about history. And of course, we've seen the term conspiracy theorist, which had its inception in theories about the Kennedy assassination, as kind of the granddaddy of them all. So I'd love to know how all this happened, how it was orchestrated. Perhaps we'll never know. With Truth News Radio Australia, we're going to break. We'll be right back. Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. I hope you check us out on the internet sometime. Have a look at our website, truthnews.com.au, and have a look at our subscribe options, because we are now offering subscriptions on our website. And as I've been explaining for the last few weeks, it's become essential that this show develops a revenue collection method, and I want to make the show better. I want to make the show bigger. I want to go in more directions. I want to include video. I'd like to have video interviews with my guests instead of just audio. Really, the sky's the limit. I would love to do so many things, and there are so many important things that need to be done. I mean, if you reflect on what I was saying in the last segment, what we're up against with the mainstream media is so coordinated, it is so despicable that we have to challenge it. But of course, if we don't have money, we can't do anything. These organizations have billions of dollars to spend, right? So, and really, there are only little shows that are often just run by someone on the smell of an oily rag that are challenging these giants. So us little guys need to get some backing. You know, we've got to get some money behind us so we can actually counteract what these monstrous organizations are doing. So have a look at our website, truthnews.com.au. The subscription options are there on the main page. You can subscribe for a year or on a monthly basis. And if you are financially challenged, if you're a student or a pensioner, or even if you're just really poor, you can choose the concession option. I'm not going to grill you over your concession status. If you're a concession subscriber, that's fine. All funds that we get are greatly respected. And there are some extra resources you'll get. And, of course, if you're a full subscriber, a full paying subscriber, you'll get the T-shirt mailed out to you. I will be making some changes to the website over the next weeks and months to basically provide more content to the subscribers. The non-subscribers will be getting the ad-supported version of the show. Subscribers will be getting the ad-free version of the show and things like that. But I'm not going to be blocking the content. The content will always be there. And by the way, our current tally of subscribers is 10. In the last show, I think I said it was 7, so we've had 3 over the last week. And great kudos to the 10 people who've joined up. I really, really respect you. You've done a great thing. 10 is great, but it's way woefully short of what we need. I need about 500, ladies and gentlemen, if I'm able to take this show in a direction that's going to actually improve it. I mean, that will net me less than 30K, probably about 27,000 after T-shirts and various other costs are paid for. But of course, I still have to have an additional source of income. It's not actually going to even be a full-time source of income for me, but it will enable me with other sources of income to use that money to make some improvements and to basically continue and keep going with the show. So check it out and have a think about it. I want to talk now a little bit about the Rolf Harris scandal and trial, and I want to lead into talking to you about Jimmy Savile, because I think that is really where the action is here. My take on Rolf Harris, and I've been doing a lot of research on it, I've read everything I can find, is that there's something amiss in the way this whole media-driven trial has been conducted. And my initial response to it was I felt that it was being concocted, that a case against Rolf Harris had been concocted because of the amount of media stunts that were sort of involved in his trial going forward. I mean, we had witnesses in the trial who never went to the police but went straight to the media and were paid large sums of money. We're talking $30,000 to $60,000 for exclusive interviews, and then after that, they went to the police. This is completely wrong. I mean, this is not a justice system. This is ludicrous. It's a circus. But of course, that does not mean that Rolf Harris is innocent. And I'm not suggesting to you that he is innocent. There are so many that have come forward now that we sort of have to accept that yes, this guy is some kind of pervert. This guy obviously has a personality disorder. He looks to me like a classic narcissist, really. He's just someone who, with a mask, someone who gratifies himself from attention, who knows how to manipulate people. And, of course, that's the great thing that narcissists do, is they're very, very good at manipulating people. And we could also talk about psychopathy. We could also talk about the mask of sanity, which is a characteristic of psychopaths, that they can put on a mask, which is very, very convincing. Now, technically, a narcissist and a psychopath are not the same thing, but there is a kind of a spectrum or a gradation between these disorders. And some of the most disturbed individuals are narcissistic psychopaths. You know, those two personality disorders can combine to produce really quite evil people. And I just say evil in objective terms. These people do very, very wicked things in the world. So what of Rolf Harris? He was convicted on 12 counts of crimes that are, although they're objectionable, they are not of the most extreme form of sex crimes. Each individual crime that he was convicted of has, I believe, a maximum sentence of about 2 years. In the end, he was sentenced to 5 years, 9 months, but then the judge determined that only half of that would be a custodial sentence. So his actual prison sentence is less than 3 years. Now, for someone who has been depicted as being a monster on the level of Jack the Ripper by the media, it's a bit of a letdown in terms of the way, in terms of the leniency of his sentence. And of course, a lot of people are complaining about that now. But then when you look at the actual crimes he was convicted for, it's probably about right according to the legal system. Now, I'm not trying to push the idea that he's not guilty. I do think he's guilty by virtue of so many people coming forwards. To the contrary, I'm being led to believe that Rolf Harris is actually far more guilty than what he's been convicted of. And this is a difficult subject to kind of talk about, because we have to understand that there is a culture of abuse. There's a culture of pedophilia in our society that's deeply hidden, and that extends through various privileged groups of people, whether we call them entertainers, very high-level politicians, even judges, very wealthy business people, politicians. There is a culture of child abuse. It goes with power, and we have to try and understand it. And this is not even new. This is something to do with the nature of power itself, is that these people believe they are above the laws that you and I have to adhere to. They almost need to demonstrate their power and demonstrate their disconnection from the normal world of morality to feel good about themselves. Because remember, this is also a culture of narcissistic psychopaths who get their supply from the power they wield over others. And how better to demonstrate that than on the most helpless people in our society? And when we come back from the break, I want to go into that in a lot more detail with Truth News from Radio Australia. Thank you. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. I've been talking about the sex crime trial of Rolf Harris, and I want to expand now into talking about the culture of power and dominance and the psychopathic mentality that underlies what's going on. And I want to try and illustrate that this is a much bigger problem than we are being led to believe. The media has given us a circus trial to look at, but which really didn't yield anything very significant, just, you know, some gropings, you know, he stuck his hand down some girl's pants. The problem is so much worse than that. And even if you just look at what we now know about Jimmy Savile, it's just 100,000 times worse than what was publicly stated about Rolf Harris. So there is an effort going on, I believe, by the co-opted, corrupt media to kind of distract everyone and not to really ever engage with this deep culture of abuse, this deep culture of the psychopathic narcissists who are the ruling elites in our society and how they operate. Of course, Jimmy Savile was right up in the upper echelons of that society. He was closely connected with the royal family, and he was in the BBC. I mean, he was a deep establishment man. And I'm going to run through with you some of the most terrific facts about Jimmy Savile. But let's just step back a minute. I want to talk about... there was a film made by Italian film director Paolo Pasolini in the 1960s. It was called Salo. You can find this on the internet. You can download a torrent of it. And I have talked about this on the show before. The film Salo is actually an adaptation of the work of the Marquis de Sade, who of course, lived several centuries ago, who was a proponent of the idea of what he called the inversion of morals. And the work of de Sade is actually very, very important, I believe, in uncovering the mentality and the psychopathy of the power elites of our society. So what is the inversion of morality? Well, in very simple terms, it's simply a trick of language. It's a way of saying black is white. It's like saying good is evil and evil is good. And it is reflective of a trend in European philosophical thought that you see culminating in people like Nietzsche. And it's about destroying the concept of the natural cosmic order of things. And as a development of intellectual thought, as an exercise, it's fine. I don't really have a problem with it. But such a concept, when used by those who have this flaw in the personality, this disordered personality that we call narcissism and psychopathy, it actually becomes a vehicle for the most abominable, cruel acts, the worst crimes that are imaginable are committed when this type of inversion occurs, when people revel in pain. This is sadism. The word, of course, comes from the Marquis de Sade. And we see it again and again throughout history in situations of war, and also in smaller instances in the crimes of very, very wicked people. But we see it large scale in wartime. And in war situations, it seems to bring out a tendency in an average person, which is towards an inversion of the normal system of morality. Now, I wanted to refer to that film by Pasolini, Salo, because Salo was based on one of de Sade's books, that I think was The 120 Days of Sodom. And the theme of the film is the torture and rape and ultimately murder of several dozen young people, children, some of them young, some of them teenagers, who are abducted off the street by fascist Italians during World War II. And they are abducted under the auspices of a group of very powerful elites, which include people like doctors, lawyers, judges, respectable business people, politicians, all the top echelons of society come together for this feast of torture and lust and ultimately murder. Ultimately, they kill each one of their victims in the most ghastly ways imaginable. And the film was banned. But bear in mind, the film doesn't actually depict a lot of graphic violence. It's described and you know it's happening in the background. You don't tend to see it much, right? The final scene where all the children are killed is done in such a way that it's all done in the distance and the perpetrators are watching it with binoculars, which is part of the kind of sick voyeuristic concept behind what they're doing. But the film was banned, and I believe the film was mainly banned because of what it suggested about the elites of our society, the way it portrayed these otherwise respectable people. And Pasolini himself said that was his main point in making the movie, right? It's not a horror flick. It's not a Texas Chainsaw Massacre type movie. He was actually trying to make a didactic point about something in our modern society, which is very real. You know, this is not just the province of fringe conspiracy theorists, folks. This is real in our society, and there are people who really do this. Okay. Of course, Kubrick again alluded to it in Eyes Wide Shut. There is clearly a connection with some sort of ritualistic behaviors. There is some sort of alternate religion. Is it satanic? Is it the ancient religion of the super powerful, Luciferianism? People have described it in various ways, but it's ritualistic, and part of the ritual is doing something very, very cruel to something very, very innocent. It's destroying innocence and reveling in destroying innocence. So let's get back to Rolf Harris and Jimmy Savile. Rolf Harris was a close friend of Jimmy Savile. They did hang out together, okay. Rolf Harris was seen visiting Broadmoor Hospital with Jimmy Savile, and he watched children get undressed at the hospital. We don't know much more than that. But what do we know about Jimmy Savile? Well, of course, he was a DJ for the BBC. He was friendly with Prince Charles. He was very close to the highest echelons of society in the UK. And his crimes are quite staggering. The police inquiry after his death covered a period of 50 years and documented 214 acts by Savile, which have been formally recorded as crimes, some involving children as young as 8. The report states within the recorded crimes there are 126 indecent acts and 34 rape penetration offences. The offences took place at 13 hospitals as well as on the BBC premises. We'll continue this with this after the break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. I'm looking at the sex crimes of Jimmy Savile and Rolf Harris. I'll be right back. Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio. And I've been talking a little today about Rolf Harris and Jimmy Savile, trying to understand this phenomenon in our society, trying to look at it from a kind of macroscopic perspective and trying to understand the mentality behind it. Savile was a monster. I have another page here from the BBC, and it's important to understand that Savile was regarded as a charity figure, and he used to visit hospitals. He visited many, many hospitals, and he had a close relationship with the administrators of these hospitals. And as part of his charity work, he was going to these hospitals, and he was raping people. He was just engaging in bestial acts with these vulnerable people in hospitals. At Leeds General Infirmary, 60 alleged victims, 33 of which were patients, 19 were children. I'm just reading to you here from a BBC page. Encounters ranged from lewd remarks and inappropriate touching to sexual assault and rape. Broadmoor Hospital, 10 victims of assault, 2 were repeatedly abused, 6 patients, 2 children and 2 staff, 1 indecent exposure to child. St Catherine's Hospital, Saxondale Mental Health Hospital, Portsmouth Royal Hospital, Dewsbury and District Hospital. It just goes on and on and on. There's just an incredibly long list of hospitals where Savile was engaging in these activities. And, you know, he raped people. And he also had sex with corpses. I mean, the man was deranged on a level that needs to be studied. It needs to be understood. It needs to be exposed. So the problem with the Rolf Harris trial is that we've just seen the tiniest tidbits of what Rolf Harris may have actually engaged in. And, of course, it's drawn so much attention, so much focus on this one individual without really exposing what the worst crimes are. So I believe it's a bit of a circus, it's a bit of a distraction, and we need to find out what's going on. We need to understand and uncover what appears to be an orchestrated culture, a cult, if you like, of ritual abuse of children by the elites. Let's leave it at that. And I hope in future shows we may be able to return to this subject and shed more light on it. Now, I do hope you stay with us for the second hour of today's show, because I have Paul Gunter from beyondnuclear.org coming on, and we're going to go into a very wide-ranging discussion about nuclear energy, the risks, the benefits, if there are indeed any. I'm certainly not against nuclear power in principle. I think it would be fantastic if nuclear power delivered what its proponents say it delivers: cheap, emission-free energy, I mean, incredibly cheap. But when we look into it, we see there are so many problems with it and so many risks that are so huge that, and then we see how badly run some of these nuclear power plants are, and it's just staggering. It really is quite horrifying. And some of the information about Fukushima about the power plant there, which Paul will reveal today, is jaw-dropping. I mean, it's criminal in nature what has been done. So do stay for the second hour, very important show. Now, I've got another very difficult topic to raise with you here. And again, it's one which challenges your morality. I want to talk about the question of euthanasia, assisted suicide. And I want to talk about Dr. Philip Nitschke, who is Australia's Dr. Death, as it were. He's the man who helps people kill themselves. At the moment, the Greens are trying to introduce a bill into Parliament that would legalise euthanasia for the terminally ill. And this is widely accepted by many people as being a good thing, because people who are dying of cancer and other illnesses should be able to die with dignity, and they should be able to make that choice. If they've run out of options, they should be facilitated in making the choice to end their lives. And indeed, what's wrong with that? Well, first of all, what I need to point out is that it's the problem is wrongly illustrated by those arguments. People who suffer from terminal illnesses already receive massive amounts of palliative pain-killing relief, which in the last stages of terminal illness are dramatically increased. And I know that from having watched my own father-in-law die, and he was given massive doses of morphine, and he was essentially helped to die. There is no other way of describing it. He had an irreversible brain tumour. They tried to operate. They did actually remove the tumour, and then it grew back within about 2 weeks. It just grew back so quickly. It was a complete waste of time operating, but they did it, and the tumour came back, and then they moved him to the hospice, which is the place where they put people who are terminal, and they just kept increasing his morphine dosage, and he died shortly thereafter. This is a very standard procedure, and sometimes it's overdone. I mean, sometimes they're a little bit too hasty with it, because, you know, often there's a shortage of places in these hospitals. There's a shortage of beds, and so with terminal patients, they kind of want to move them on. So what I'm pointing out there is that there's already a culture of euthanasia that exists in hospitals. But the Greens want to fully legalise terminating one's life, so that instead of this something sort of being done on the quiet by the hospital staff, it's like you can sit up in bed and say, well, I'm going now, you know, here it is, I'm taking the pill, see you later. You know, and, you know, it sounds good, doesn't it? But it only sounds good if it's you, the patient, you, the sufferer, making the decision completely voluntarily. And I certainly support that. But once you make it fully legal, you also make it possible for scenarios to develop where people could be co-opted into taking the pill. And people who are very weak, people who are very old, can easily be co-opted for all kinds of reasons. And some terminal illnesses take years and years to actually bring about, you know, final end. So, I mean, that's expensive, right? So it's very easy to make an argument that that it's the best thing for all concerned to sort of end it quickly, even if you don't really need to. Now, Philip Nitschke actually goes a lot further than what the Greens have proposed in his own attitude to this. And he actually assists people to kill themselves who are not even sick. And this is a huge scandal at the moment in Australia, because a recent case, and there have been others, of people emailing him and him basically telling them what to do, and he stands by it and says, well, it's fine. You know, they made a rational decision, and I was simply giving them the information they needed. So he agrees that they're not sick. Those who criticize what he's done suggest that these people may have been depressed. But Nitschke says, well, no, he doesn't believe they're depressed. He just believes that that they wanted to die. And he, and I'm sure many other people in our society, would like to see that completely legalized as well. And again, I'm not all in favor of laws to prevent people from doing anything they want. It's, to me, it's not really about the law, but it's about what would be the implications of revoking the laws or bringing in new laws that kind of enshrine people's right to end their lives with dignity. Well, I put it to you that what will happen is that this will be used for the greater good, for the nanny state to optimize health resources. It will be used for that purpose. It's a utilitarian mechanism. Once it's legal, right, and all you need is the consent of the individual, then all you need to do is pressure that individual. And there's many ways that that can occur. There are many greedy, grasping people in the world who, unfortunately, there are many people with personality disorders in our world. There are people who are deeply disturbed, who have a moral vacuum or have an inversion of morals in their psyche. And they can rationalize bumping off mum or dad or grandma. They can rationalize it. And they can rationalize it as being for the greater good. And there are ethicists, like a guy from Harvard whose name I just can't remember, Peter Singer, who actually endorses this as well. He says people who are not socially useful should be eliminated. So this is a thin end of the wedge type situation. Once you legalize euthanasia, you create a scenario whereby Peter Singer's social rationalism, greater good, ethicism will kick in. But actually it will be driven by the greed of people with personality disorders, narcissists, psychopaths. It will be driven by those sort of people. We're going to break. We'll be back in hour two with Paul Gunter from beyondnuclear.org. Really a great interview coming up. Don't miss it.